Welcome to CounselorAudioSource.net. Counselor Audio Source is a weekly podcast dedicated to the professional enhancement of practicing counselors, supervisors, and counselor educators. Look for us on the web at CounselorAudioSource.net. This week, contributing editor Adina Renfro-Michel interviews Dr. John J. Paragoy, both faculty at Morehead State University, about counseling Native American Alaskan Native clients. Dr. Paragoy is current president of the Society of Indian Psychologists, an affiliate of the American Psychological Association.
Welcome, Dr. Paragoy, to CounselorAudioSource.net.
Thank you, Adina. It's a pleasure and an honor to be here.
We're glad to have you. I want to begin our discussion on working with Native American clients, kind of clarifying some terminology. I was always taught to use the politically correct term Native American, but I've heard you speak about yourself and others as Indian. Could you please explain those two terms and the appropriate uses of both?
Sure. You know, it seems that with each era, there's a preferred term that different groups of people prefer to be called or call themselves. And in the U.S. today, and if we look at the research base, we're seeing that American Indian and Alaskan Native is the phrase that's the most popular now. I like to use the example regarding terminology and what people like to be called as simply asking you, where were you born?
New Orleans.
In New Orleans. So you're a Native American.
You're right.
So that's an explanation I use. In the past, Alaskan Natives have been excluded, and the term Native American was used by itself. Some people have gone as far to use the label Native American Indians to try and capture all those different components. I think it's interesting that when you look at outsiders looking in, especially with political correctness being at the forefront of our minds these days, people want to use the appropriate phrase. It's important not to inhibit yourself in interacting with somebody in fear of insulting them. I think that if we can be compassionate and look to them to see how they want to be identified, then that's the important first step to take. Well, when you see a bunch of Indians, if you will, sitting around, we're going to ask each other what tribe we're from, and we'll refer to each other from the tribe we're from.
Which terminology would you like me to use for this interview?
You can call me John.
All right, John. Could you please explain deculturative stress?
Deculturative stress. Deculturative stress is a construct that refers to the stress that an individual or a group of people experience when their values, mores, social norms are not accepted or not embraced by a dominant group. And it's the stress of losing one's culture, which is imposed from external demands. Deculturative stress and culture shedding are two constructs that go hand in hand. When we look at culture shedding, we're looking at the cessation of a set of behaviors that are culturally prescribed or directed, and the replacement of those behaviors with new behaviors imposed again by a broader or a larger cultural and social context.
So could you give me an example?
An example might be, if we look at Indian country today, it was after the Indian Wars way back in the olden days, and I say that tongue in cheek, it was legal to gather together and conduct a sun dance, for example. And although these ceremonies that were legalized by the U.S. government were continued underground, if you will, mm-hmm. The stress of not being able to fully participate, not necessarily in a public venue, but in an open venue, for example, like you going to church. We couldn't practice our ceremonies openly.
Right.
So in a sense, that could be considered a form of deculturative stress. I think that's only one tip of that broad iceberg of deculturative stress.
Okay. Thank you. How does that affect a Native American having to deal with not being able to practice their spirituality?
Well, the laws have changed recently. Mm-hmm. The American Indian Religious Freedom Act, as originally passed in 1978 and ratified in 79, and then that was retracted in 80, was replaced by what we lovingly refer to as the Peyote Bill, or the Religious Freedom Act of the mid-1990s. And essentially it said that we could again practice a wide variety of ceremonies. And it included the use of peyote. And peyote was an illegal substance unless you have a special dispensation from the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Agency, to transport it here and there. DEA, by the way, firmly supported the passing of that particular bill, because they were having to track down individuals who were carrying peyote buttons, for example, for the Native American church ceremonies, and having to arrest people that were motivated by religious and spiritual practices versus making money.
Right.
Yeah.
But I can imagine that limits on practicing your religion and spirituality over that much time, over the generations, mm-hmm. has definitely affected the culture today.
It has. You know, and when we talk about the culture, there's not just one culture.
Right.
We have to see there's over 557 federally and state-recognized tribes in the United States of America. You know, and I'm glad you brought this up, because it's something we need to address up front. With 557 different state and federally recognized tribes, and over 200 dialects or 200 different languages, we see that each tribe practices its own ceremonial and religious ways. There's a concept called pan-Indianism. And pan-Indianism can be viewed as those activities that tribal peoples may hold in common. For example, one of the pan-Indian values we see, and this has emerged from the old boarding school days, where certain songs were shared and are commonly sung by a wide group of different Indian peoples across the nation. So we have pan-Indian values. We also have, when we look at tribes and we look at individuals, we see that just as with individuals, there are different levels of acculturation. And acculturation is key when we're looking at working with clients. Just as different clients will have different levels of acculturation, so too will different tribes have a different level of acculturation. So we look at it from an individual and a group perspective. For example, the Diné people, which are the Navajo people. Most people refer to them as the Navajo. They have retaken their original name that they called themselves, which is Diné, and I hope I've pronounced that correctly, as well as the Crow and the Northern Cheyenne tribes. Taking those three tribes as an example, between 92 and 96, maybe 97% of those people living on the reservation who were raised and living on those reservations speak their native language in their home. Now, the flip side of that is my tribe, Flathead Nation. We're called Flatheads. That was a mistake by Lewis and Clark, but that's another story. We were one of the first reservations open to white settlement, and this created a lot of interaction between whites and Indians, as well as contributed to interracial marriages. But our language was dramatically lost and has been making a comeback, if you will, since the late 60s, early 1970s. So here we have two different sets of groups looking at the level of acculturation. We've got tribal peoples speaking their native language in their home to tribal groups such as my tribe not having the ability and the fluency of their traditional language. So we see different levels of acculturation. So we have to look, when we're working particularly with clients, at number one, what is their level of acculturation?
Okay. And that actually walks right into one of my questions is, what's some specific information that we need to ask when doing an intake with someone who is Native?
Well, first of all, as counselors providing mental health services off the reservation, we're more likely to see clients than behavioral health specialists on the reservation. Behavioral health specialists are counseling psychologists, clinical psychologists, traditionally in the Indian Health Service realm, that provide services to tribal peoples. They have opportunity to see more traditional people than we would as counselors off the reservation with no relationship to, for example, the Bureau of Indian Affairs or Indian Health Services.
Okay.
Oh, by the way, do you know what BIA stands for?
No.
Bosses Indians Around.
Yeah,
Bureau of Indian Affairs used to be in the Department of War. And now it's in the Department of Interior, as opposed to an enemy. We are now a renewable resource.
Anyway. Interesting.
So what are some of those things we might want to do during an intake process? First of all, I think it's very important for us to understand the client's level of acculturation. How do they see themselves? It's very important. So what I tell people when I do workshops and what I tell my students is just because an Indian comes into your office doesn't mean it's because it's an Indian issue.
Right.
It's not a red issue necessarily. So we need to understand, first of all, the client's presenting concern. What are the issues for the client? But in tandem with that, we need to understand what their level of acculturation is and their level of identity. Very important. Akin to that, we need to understand how they view change, just as with any client. What role does religion and ceremonial life play in the individual's life? And in exploring that with your client, you can help identify whether it would be important for them to become involved with a traditional healer, you know, a medicine person or from their tribe or from another tribe. So these are some of the beginning things you want to look at when starting to work with a Indian or Native client.
Thank you. What are some issues facing Native Americans and Alaskan Natives?
You know, there's a broad array of issues. If we look at the literature, and it's been my experience as well, one of the major issues is depression, self-esteem, and depression. The stresses of living in two worlds is very demanding, or are very demanding. And if we look at the reservations, again, there's over 557 of them, both state and federally recognized. They're, it's been said they're high on scenery, but low on other economic resources, and scenery doesn't pay that much. We see high levels of unemployment. Mm-hmm. Indian dropout rates in schools are dismal. For every 100 children that begin elementary school or their tenure in K through 12, we see about 30 maybe graduating high school.
Wow.
Out of those that go to college, we may see only a handful complete a four-year degree. However, that has changed with the advent of tribal colleges, tribally controlled colleges. There are 32 of those in the nation.
And aren't there tribal elementary schools and high schools now also?
Yes, there are as well.
Okay.
One of the things that we see with the tribal colleges is that they are meeting the needs, the learning needs of Native students, and have been quite successful in improving educational level on many reservations. Tribal colleges have a charge to address local community needs, such as cultural needs. So there are courses in herbs, canning, things of that nature, brain tanning, how to tan a hide just using the artifacts of the carcass that you're working with, as well as examining spiritual issues in a venue that's safe, supportive, and embracing of the individual's culture.
Non-prejudicial.
Yeah, and very, very committed to cross-cultural and, quote-unquote, Indian education. Because there was always education before the white man came. There was Indian education. So education is just not a new phenomenon since that Italian guy that worked for the Spanish got lost. Anyway.
Well, as the education system has been trying to change to meet the needs of Native Americans, counselors also need to take a shift in the way they see counseling in the counseling process.
Absolutely.
Okay, can you describe some differences?
You know, again, I'm gonna give you a caveat that says, first of all, we have to look at the client's level of cooperation. If they indeed an active Indian, if you will, for lack of a better phrase, and that's not a good phrase at all, but if they're practicing their traditional spiritual practices and have been raised with a worldview as an Indian person, then what we look at is we have to make education applicable to that individual's everyday life, just with any other student that we work with. But we have to look at it from an Indian perspective. We have to look at it with an Indian eye. We have to take into consideration, what does it mean for this child to be in this classroom? Are they the only Indian kid in that classroom? What are some of the stressors being the only Indian kid in the classroom? And at the college level, it's like professors will look at you and say, now I want you to speak for all Indians across the whole United States, Central America, and Canada. You know, and that's a big stressor to be the Indian expert. As well, let's just focus on the college level. Indian kid walks into the classroom, and my research has garnered some of this information that I'm sharing. Is one of the questions they ask themselves is, you know, what are these people thinking about me? Do they think I'm an affirmative action admit? That kind of self-talk is not conducive to success.
So what can a counselor do to change the way that they're doing counseling in order to help Native Americans with their issues?
Well, first of all, you know, go back to earlier. Understand what level of acculturation that student's at.
Okay.
Find out what stressors they are experiencing. And this is just good counseling right here.
Right.
Find out how they have been successful in dealing with those same stressors in the past. To work on their strengths. We have, for such a long time, been working on a deficit model, even in counselor education, that we have to really do that paradigm shift and start looking at people's strengths. What kind of support does that student have or does that client have? Do they have people in the Indian community that they can find support? Can they participate in spiritual or religious activities that are meaningful to them? For example, smudging ceremonies. Do they smudge themselves? And smudging, as you know, is the burning of sweet grass or cedar or the like, and fanning the smoke to purify an area or to purify yourself, so that your prayers are carried to the Creator on the smoke and the medicine that what we call the medicine that, mm-hmm. that carries our prayers to Creator. So by encouraging the client to perhaps reconnect or to, as opposed to reconnecting, continue or seek out other folks, other Indian folks that can support them from a spiritual perspective. And at the same time, if we have a client, let me give you an example, okay? One of the cases I consulted on was a non-Indian counselor was working with an Indian woman from the Northern Plains, and this was in a intermountain metropolitan area in the Rocky Mountains. And the woman who was the client was very concerned and was under a tremendous amount of duress. She felt that there was some witchcraft that had taken place against her and that she was beginning to lose her soul. And soul lost is a soul loss is a culturally specific category. Okay, it's even mentioned in the DSM-4-TR as an indigenous issue. Anyway, the counselor called me and said, "What can I do?" And she had already been established in the Native community, the counselor had. Otherwise, this woman would not have come to see her at all to begin with.
Okay.
So the first thing is, and this woman spent a year in the community trying to gain trust, build trust, become a known person. Very important. You got to get out. You got to establish who you are if you're going to be working in the Native community, because trust is a major issue because of the impact of historical distrust.
Mm-hmm.
And historical distrust developed out of many years of broken treaties, as well as, for example, the sterilization of Indian peoples. 25% of all Indian peoples, 15% women, 10% men, were sterilized without prior consent up until the late 1970s. Okay? So as a group of people, we've developed this kind of sense of distrust. So a counselor needs to get out in the community, get their face seen, be genuine, and express their concern, their commitment, and support for the community. Okay. So once you establish trust, people will come and see you. And
so I just want to stop you for 1 second. So that means going to the gatherings, going to the powwows, going into the homes and meeting people.
If you're invited into the
homes.
If you're invited. Yeah. Exactly. You've got to be out in the community and participating in whatever those community events are.
Okay.
And there are a lot of Indian organizations in large cities also that you can tap into to work with. So that's an important consideration. So we're going back to our example of the client, already okay. establishing trust. The client did an intake with the counselor vice versa. The counselor called me up and said, you know, this is kind of like above me because we're talking about witchcraft. We're talking about good and evil, which is real for this client. We have to honor the client's worldview. We have to recognize, for example, what good and evil and what witchcraft means for this person we're working with. We can't poo-poo it because it's out of our realm of understanding.
Right.
We have to honor it.
Right.
And so many of our belief systems, particularly those rooted in the Judeo-Christian tradition, might be challenged by some of the differences that a counselor will experience in terms of social and cultural practices. So here the counselor's seeking a consultation. My recommendations were that the counselor would be able to work with the client on stress management and stress reduction, assist the client and explore with the client nutrition, etc., etc. Basic counseling arenas in which we work with every day. And the client, if agreeable, needed to see a traditional healer so that they could work in tandem together on the client's particular issue, which was feeling that somebody had worked witchcraft or negative bad witchcraft on her, resulting in the beginning of soul loss. Okay. So part of that process is recognizing people that we can access in the community who are going to serve for us as key informants, if you will, from a qualitative research paradigm. A key informant would be somebody in the community who, number one, trusts you, but would be able to give you insight into what soul loss might be. How does soul loss reflect itself in a person who's having their soul being stolen? And to help you understand, as the counselor, things that may be totally alien to you, because it's just not within your Judeo-Christian history.
I also understand that counselors tend to be glued to their offices.
Oh, yeah.
We like to have clients come to us, sit down in a surrounding that's familiar to us.
Mm-hmm.
But working with Indian clients, it isn't always appropriate to do that.
No, I agree with you. It's important to recognize that therapy doesn't take place in the golden hour in your office. It can take place out on the basketball court shooting hoops. It can take place walking in the woods or going out to sit by a river to visit, to perhaps do a ceremony before you begin, and have the client, if they're so inclined, lead a smudging ceremony for you before you begin and end. So being tied to our office is an archaic concept that is going to be fast ending if we are to continue to be effective as change agents in a multicultural world.
We talked a little bit about Native Americans being very distrustful of outsiders and having difficulty going to counseling because of that, because they're until they really get to know the counselor. What are some other barriers for Native Americans seeking mental health services?
You know, one of the barriers that still exists and was first addressed in the 1970s by the Indian Child Welfare Act is the misunderstanding of the extended family system. The extended family system is both a kith and kin system, just like many other groups have. In other words, you have your immediate family, and then you, if you're a member of a clan, you will have your clan family, and then you'll have your band or tribal family. And these people can be what's termed in the business kith or kin, either blood relations or relations that are created through social mechanisms in terms of clans and or Uncle Harry or Aunt Jane, who are best friends of our parents. So the extended family system has been misunderstood. Child neglect has been imposed, has been a construct that has been imposed on Indian families for eons. And the Indian Child Welfare Act was and is one effort to recognize and value the importance of family and tribal cohesion and tribal identity. If a child was given to an aunt or an uncle, or went to go stay with an aunt or an uncle for a week, from an outside agency perspective, that might be considered an inconsistent relationship for that child because the parents aren't present 100% of the time. And this was quite often the case. Many Indian children were taken from homes inappropriately, some appropriately, but many inappropriately, because of the misunderstanding of the importance in the function of the extended family system.
We spoke today a lot about issues that Native Americans are dealing with, and specifically what counselors need to keep in mind when working with Native Americans. But one of the overall themes that I've heard you say is something that we always say as counselors anyway, when we feel that we're in a little bit too deep and we don't understand, we don't have the educational background to understand what's going on, to seek consultation.
Absolutely.
And so the ACA ethical guidelines are very specific in seeking consultation and also being very multicultural competent with the clients that we're working with. So I just wanted to point that out for our audience, that that is obviously a theme that continues with no matter who we work with, but also specifically with Native American and Native Alaskan clients.
Absolutely. It's cool to be Indian now. With the advent of Southwestern jewelry and the movie Dances with Wolves, more people are aware of Indian people in the everyday sense, yet we have a whole host of myths and stereotypes that we have to combat. Mm-hmm. One of the things I caution mental health workers about is not being seduced by the exotic. And what I mean by that is, we'll go back to an earlier example, and that was the woman who was experiencing soul loss because of the witchcraft that was practiced on her. Well, those are kind of things out of the general counselor's realm of everyday experience. So it sounds pretty intriguing. And to get lost in that phenomena alone is a disservice and unethical.
Right.
But, you know, it's just a part of human nature, too, because they're hearing something new that sounds pretty neat in a way, and going off on a tangent without addressing what the needs of the client are. So, you know, one of my cautions are when working with Indian people or other groups is not to be seduced by the exotic. Many myths abound regarding American Indian people, and what we need to do is we need to set those myths aside. Many people view Indians solely as in the past, and we're not in the past. We're in the present, and we are contributing to the fabric of American society on a daily basis. So that's something I want our listeners to really take a good, strong look inside And what's the first thing you think of when I say American Indian? Is it somebody in loincloths? Is it a drunkard? Is it poverty? Is it the proud stoic Indian that was portrayed by Iron Eyes Cody? I was going to say Ben Nighthorse Campbell, but that's a senator. there's a whole host of stereotypes that we have been raised with that I really want our listeners to begin to challenge for themselves. And in challenging that, open up to learning more about what is it to be American Indian in today's society.
Thank you. I also want to just say that it really depends on the area of the country that we're living in, that the specific prejudices regarding Native Americans. Because when I was teaching community college students in Mississippi, their first words were, Native Americans are rich. Mm-hmm. Because of all the casinos, which is also not the case.
Right.
So it's interesting to know not only our prejudices, but the prejudices in the community that a client is living in as well.
Absolutely. Now, the gaming in Indian country only began in 1989 with the advent of the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act. And not all tribes have gaming. And that's important to keep in mind. Tribes that have gaming can only, well, any tribe that wants to have gaming can only have the same level of gaming that exists in the state already.
I did not know that.
Right. So gaming will never happen in Utah because,
right,
because there's no legalized gambling in Utah, and I don't foresee it being implemented in the near future. So gaming is not a panacea, and many people see gaming as a panacea, mm-hmm, and an answer to Indian economic problems, and it's simply not. Yeah.
I want to thank you for speaking with us today. Is there anything else that we have not talked about that you would like to say?
Well, you know, there's loads of stuff, and so we'll be doing this interview probably for the next 5 years. There's just tons of issues that Indian people face on a daily basis. Depression is probably one of the major issues that is faced across the nation, and it's for a variety of reasons. It's for institutional race. It's a response to institutional racism. It's a response to communities that have poor economics, unemployment, many of these issues.
Poverty so prevalent.
Is very prevalent. And I would just encourage our listeners to pick up a couple good books and read them. Vine Deloria, who's just recently passed away, has a wonderful book, and it's got a print date of somewhere in the 1970s called Custer Died for Your Sins. I would encourage people to pick that book up. It's a fast read, and it's a good read. It's a bit shocking. Paula Gunn Allen has written some good pieces on regaining the feminine for women in Indian country. So I would just encourage our listeners to continue reading, recognize that good counseling is very important, and yet there are multicultural competency skills that people need to develop to be effective. And on that note, I just want to thank you for this opportunity and wish our listeners to have a good life.
Thank you for sharing your knowledge with us.
Thank you.
You've just heard an interview of Dr. John J. Paragoy of Morehead State University regarding counseling Native American, Alaskan Native clients. The interview was done by CounselorAudiosource.net contributing editor Adina Renfro-Michelle. Look for previous podcasts, show notes, and listener feedback on the podcast website at CounselorAudiosource.net. Listeners can leave comments or questions for our interview guests or hosts through our Skype.com internet telephone ID, Counselor Audio Source, or by calling 330-871-4015. Counseling techniques and interventions discussed in the Counselor Audio Source broadcast are meant for use by counseling professionals, and Counselor Audio Source is not held liable for any use of the techniques mentioned in the program. Our music bed today is Memorial Day from Jamie Beauchamp. His and other PodSafe music can be found in the PodSafe Music Network at podshow.com. Counselor Audio Source is licensed under the Creative Commons, a nonprofit organization offering a flexible copyright for creative work.